This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better public land hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with this and who knows, maybe we will learn something together.
All right, so Clay and I are sitting here and we are talking to Jake DeBoe. And Jake, would you like to introduce yourself for everybody listening on the podcast?
Yeah, my name is Jake DeBoe. I live in northern New Hampshire, so a little bit of a northeast representation here. I'm a hunter, a trapper, you know, all around outdoorsman. I'm a wildlife biologist, and I try to stay in the woods as much as possible.
That's amazing. I actually, Jake, didn't know who you were, and Luke sent me a bunch of your told me how to find you on Instagram, and I've been looking through your page over the last day, just going, wow, you know, after all the cool posts that you put up. You have some really amazing content, and I too trap beaver, but I don't even compare as far as the numbers because I only probably trap a couple a year.
Yeah, well, hey, just the fact that you're out there, man, that's what matters. And the more beaver trappers, the better. But yeah, the content stuff, it kind of just happened. There was never an intention to go down that road and start a channel, but there was obviously a need, and we kind of fell into it. So here we are.
Nice. Yeah, I myself haven't ever trapped beavers. It was something I thought maybe I could get into this year. I stopped and asked permission from someone, and they already had somebody trapping the property. And honestly, the whole reason I wanted to do it was so that my creek, if the rain happened to be a lot of rain in a rainfall, that I wouldn't flood out on my back of my property. So, I mean, dual purpose, you know, manage the land the best way I can, and then manage the resource of the beavers and utilize the meat, the fur, all that good stuff. But I did just recently get into trapping coyotes, which I thought was pretty cool. And then I did my first two ground sets and actually got two coyotes this year. So that was cool.
Nice. Congratulations. That's not an easy feat to jump into canine trapping and be successful. So congrats.
Thanks.
I've never done it successfully, Luke, and I've given it a whirl.
I mean, the thing was, I only trapped my own property. I wanted to reduce the number to where it's a little bit more manageable because my neighbors and everybody's complaining about them kind of exploding and the population being almost to the point where it's out of hand. And I just wanted to try and manage it. And I'm like, man, the best way I could do it is probably trap it. That way, you know, you don't educate. If you're hunting them, it seems like you tend to educate a lot of other coyotes as well. So I was like, I think the best way to do this is probably trap them. And I don't know. I just did some research, watched a few YouTube videos, and went to YouTube University, bought some traps, boiled them, threw some black walnuts in there when I was boiling them. And then, first I boiled them in dish soap to try and get off all the oil, and then reboiled them a second time and put black walnut hulls in there and did that. And then just took them and dipped them in wax, made a huge mess in the kitchen. Don't ever do that in the kitchen. I actually spilled, I was doing it in like a pan and melted it in the oven, and then just thought I could like bring the pan out. And as I brought the pan out, I hit the edge of the oven, like the knobs, and it dumped all over in the kitchen. My wife was so mad that I got wax everywhere. And it was like a whole week I was scraping wax. Like I'd notice more and have to like clean it up, and huge mess. But at the end of the day, I guess it was kind of worth it, right? I skinned them out and flushed them and everything. And, you know, so I got two coyote pelts.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the cool thing about trapping versus hunting. And not that there's not a lot of preparation stuff with other types of hunting, but you just had an entire story about before you even set a trap, you know, so there's this ritual associated with the beginning of each season and getting the traps ready and kind of fine tuning stuff. And then there's the actual season, then there's the fur handling. And so it tends to be a bit more all encompassing. And that's part of the attraction of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Clay tends to trap and eat the beaver. I know that you eat beaver and seen a lot of it. What's like your favorite way to prepare the beaver? I'm just kind of curious on that one.
Steaks. And I know it sounds like lame. Like I don't have some crazy good recipe, but beaver steaks. So the backstraps and the sirloins. If you've never had beaver sirloin, you're missing out on probably the best cut of meat that occurs on the landscape. I actually just had it for dinner. I mean, 20 minutes ago.
That's awesome.
So we take the backstraps, and the sirloin is kind of where the backstrap meets the back ham, the back leg. You know, it's the same makeup as a deer or a bear. If you cut or butcher your own meat, it's just every animal, that actual muscle group's a bit different based on what they're using their legs for, right? So a deer, that sirloin's this big, long, large disc because they're made for jumping and running, whereas a beaver's made for squatting and pulling. So it's a little bit more of a block. It's kind of a cube, if you will. It's nice. Good stuff.
Are you grilling them or sous vide them, sauteing them, like cooking them in a pan? What?
Straight up on the grill. I mean, I've had it camp style in a cast iron pan as well. But a good marinade. My wife makes a phenomenal marinade, and so toss that in there for a couple hours to get soaking, and then just straight up on the grill. I mean, I think the thing with the back straps is that they're a bit thin. So you got to just real quick be on it. So knowing the different cuts and just the sizes and how they cook, I think you could prepare it like you would any other meat. I mean, to us, it's just become another red meat that we pull out of the freezer for dinner.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I have to say that I fully agree 100% beaver backstrap. We have called last meal. Like if you were in on death row in my family, both me and my son and a couple others agreed that you want to get your last meal, it's going to have beaver backstrap in it because it's so good. And like I'll cook it, or I catch a beaver, and usually the tradition is that night we eat beaver backstrap. And I mean, I got three kids. You said they're really thin. So if you get a small beaver, I mean, it's like barely enough for anybody to have food, but everybody cherishes those little tiny morsels they get.
Yeah. My wife has attributed it to lamb. I haven't eaten a lot of lamb, so I can't say one way or the other, but it's just that rich, dark red meat. And I guess it's really high in protein, and it's part of the reason that it's so dark. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like that last meal. That would probably be on my plate as well. Although if you haven't tried the sirloin, Clay, you gotta try cutting that out.
Yeah, I mean, I've eaten all the meat on every beaver. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And I do have a question for you though. So back hams, are you just deboning the meat then, or are you ever just like throw it? Like I tend to throw it in the crock pot and just kind of whole and just cook them.
Yeah, so that's, I would say that's our go-to. Because, you know, and there's a little pocket of fat. If you're going to do that, you know, you trim the outside and there's this little pocket of fat between, well, I guess it's on the back of the femur that I'll kind of flay in and take that out. Because I have had once or twice made a meal where it was a little on the gamier side, which is odd because beaver is not gamey. And so I kind of tried to dive into what that was. And once I started removing that little pocket of fat, we were able to avoid that. But yeah, so that's the go-to. We have a barbecue pulled beaver recipe that, like, if we're going to any function, we're gonna have some friends together, whatever it may be, it's easy to put, it's easy to toss together, and you know, it can be a novelty to others. But we have deboned, made jerky, made stews, you know, all sorts of different things. But as you know, those muscle groups are just smaller, so once you start parsing them apart, it can take a lot of trimming to kind of get it down to a piece of meat that you want to use, whether it's for jerky or anything else.
I see.
Yeah. But yeah, the crock pot. Ooh, beaver in the crock pot is a staple.
Nice. Now yeah. I don't know. I feel bad that I never caught any beavers. I want to eat the beaver. You got to catch the beaver.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to work on that a little more.
Yeah, I've got two friends this year that got into beaver trapping for the food aspect. And, you know, they went out, they caught two or three beavers, and they, you know, single guys living at home alone, and were able to feed themselves for a week or more on a nice big 40-pound beaver.
Yeah.
And now they're hooked on trapping for a food aspect, which you just don't hear of often. And that's the beauty of the beaver.
Yeah. So are you, do you eat the liver?
I've never tried the liver. I've also never tried the tail. And whenever anyone asks me, my response is, have you ever had beaver backstrap? You know, it's like when I'm cutting meat at the end of the day in the fur shed, it's after you've had backstrap, it's hard to imagine getting in there for the liver.
But yeah, yeah. We eat liver in our house a lot. So any animal that I catch, I'm going to keep the liver. Cool. And beaver liver is great. Yeah, I mean, it's like... there are animals that I just think like have good tasting livers. And sure. One of them would be like porcupine. Like they have like an oversized liver. So I always think that's like a good, and yeah, it's not a backstrap, but it's meat and high in a lot of essential nutrients that we need for health.
For sure.
And I have actually had the tail. But how I do the tail is, I'll just throw it in the crock pot and just cook the tail down and render fat. And so I'll make a real fatty broth and, then kind of just scrape it off the top and, you can use it as cooking oil.
Nice. We were actually just talking about, we're about to skin all our tails. So we save all our tails throughout the year. We'd have one big, you know, thaw them out, have one big skinning party for them. Cause it's kind of a whole thing. We were just talking about trying to render it down. So maybe we'll try the crock pot method.
Yeah, it's super easy.
Soap. I mean, if you're rendering it down, I just rendered, oh my gosh, I don't know, probably, I don't know, 50 pounds, 40 pounds of tallow the
other
day. Wow. And my wife, she's like, because I did it while we were doing a podcast, and then afterwards, like, went out, and then I was like, oh, crap. So I shut it off, and the next day I turned it on, ran out of propane, it turned into, like, a big thing. Well, by the time I was done, like, heating it and pouring it in and all this stuff, I did it on our back deck, which was really dumb. Also a learning lesson, because it was the first time I did it outside. She used to let me do it inside, and then she's like, the smell is just too bad. Do it outside. So I did it on the back deck. Terrible idea. Do it, like, in the grass where when stuff drips everywhere. So I was out there with a broom and a scrub brush and dish soap for, like, half the day scrubbing and getting all the stuff off. But
we're gonna have to rename this the cleaning podcast.
Yeah. You want to hear my first bear grease story?
Oh, nice. Yes.
Sounds pretty similar. We put it on at like 9 o'clock at night, thinking I won't take too long. 3 a.m you know, you're still kind of stirring the pot. We fell asleep on the couch, woke up to the sound of, we have an electric burner, woke up to the sound of sizzling. And it boiled over onto our electric burner at about 3 o'clock in the morning. It was days of cleaning that up.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I'm publicly challenged. I guess I'm challenged within the home as well. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I got a question for you. I didn't do enough looking back through your profile today, but it seems like you use a lot of 330s. Are you using others, or is it the public image of trapping? You want to keep it to simply using 330s because that's a lot more humane.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think there's a couple different ways to go about that. One, no, we use a lot of body grips, specifically through the ice. Through the ice, I'd say we're using 98% body grips. Once we have open water, I am running a lot of footholds on submersion devices. And from an ethical standpoint, the way that beaver dies, you know, beavers die what's called a dry death when they're in a submersion set. And so they're not drowning like you and I think of it. You know, they hold their breath for so long. Essentially, the CO2 builds up, and it's just like using a gas chamber. An approved way of euthanasia by the, you know, American Veterinary Association. So we do use that, and we do show that a bit, but just the nature of it, because a lot of the stuff that we were making kind of comes from the winter months. And also, as I'm sure you saw, kind of the impetus of our page is breaking down that barrier of entry for new trappers. And using footholds on submersion devices can be, it's a lot more moving parts. You kind of got to have depth. You got to understand where that animal's moving. Whereas body grip, that animal's interacting with it. You're showing up. It's dead. There's less opportunity for mishap. And so we definitely highlight that a bit more.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I've had this, you know, a few times throughout the years, as I'm sure you have as well, but I had a mishap just the other day. Our trapping season here in Michigan goes until the 26th of this month.
Okay.
And I came upon a set the other day that had a beaver hand in it. And sure. And I was like, ah, crap, you know, and I'm feeling obvious remorse for the animal as well. But honestly, also just like the fact that like now there's a, like I didn't get a beaver. And I really wanted to get at least, you know, one before the season ends. And then now there's a one-handed beaver out there that may or may not survive.
Was it in a body grip or foothold?
It was a foothold. Yeah.
So first off, worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like you show up to the set and it happens. You run this year. I just did my math out. We ran 550 trap nights. You know, you put that many sets out and there's going to be mishaps, but it's so rare. And so the BMPs that are set for these traps and the footholds that you're using is MB750 or CDRs or.
You know what, man, I'm going to tell you, I am like probably the worst person for names of things because like I've been trapping since about 2015. But I just don't, I'm not good with like names of products, you know?
Hey, you don't need to be. It's a foothold, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's a big foothold.
Yeah. It's like a size D or whatever, you know, like one that you're going to use for beavers.
Yeah. And so, you know, all these new traps are made to these BMP standards, and the standards factor in some amount of, you know, just the risk associated with life. You know, if when you're going to check your traps and you get in your vehicle, you have a higher chance of something happening to you in the vehicle than you do having one of these mishaps in a trap. But sometimes it happens. So one thing I will say, I mean, it's happened to me, and I always put a lot of effort into targeting that specific individual moving forward.
Yeah.
Just to close the chapter, right? But I will say I have one story of, you know, a very similar thing happened. I caught a beaver in a body grip. Body grips are, you know, by a foot, so it's a very, very unique catch. It doesn't happen often. And those body grips are not made to hold a beaver by the foot. And so I showed up and there's the foot, and it, you know, it haunted me, as I'm sure it did you. And I targeted that area. It's pretty close to home. The next year, made a bunch of sets, caught some other beavers, never caught that one beaver, but had some tampering, had some body grips that were pushed over, that were fired, maybe a stick pushed through it. And I kind of suspected that individual was still on the landscape. So fast forward another year, trapped all season, same thing. Things were going on, but caught a few other beavers. But it was the late spring or late winter, early spring, and I made an otter set that was just on a blind corner. And I put a little bit of beaver oil hanging just as a curiosity thing if an otter's cruising by. But also, hey, if there's a beaver in the area. Well, I caught that beaver, that specific beaver that had, you know, had lost a foot. And it was completely healed over. 100% healed over. That beaver had a lodge just upstream. It was living a totally normal life. And it was completely furred over. But I did the math out. That individual beaver, it eluded 12 of my sets in a 3-year period. Like, it interacted with, after I caught it the first time, 12 of my sets in a 3-year period before I was able to catch up with them. So beavers can go from being one of the, you know, quote unquote, easier animals to catch to the second that they smarten up to, you know, square, they become square smart with body grips.
Yeah.
They can turn into the hardest animal to catch on the landscape.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's seriously educated them at that point.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
I've had far more success, in my experience with, footholds and, even snares throughout the year.
Yeah.
You know,
I've never messed around with snares. We do have the ability to use them in water and under ice, but, and I've got a few hanging on the wall. I just haven't kind of jumped into that world yet.
I tell you what, man, if you have what you're describing right now, you have that happening where you're like, what the heck is going on? You know, you keep having traps go off like your conibears. You just slip a snare in that exact same spot. And I've caught so many beavers that way through the years.
Yeah, cool.
Well, not so many. You've caught more beavers probably this year than I've ever caught.
It's not about numbers, though. It's just about, and it's about all these different techniques. Like, see, I've never used snares or cable restraints or anything on beaver.
Yeah.
So I've got a question from like a beginner standpoint then. You say it's easier to do a body hold than it is to do like a leg hold and set a trap. And then if you're doing that, how would you go about setting the body trap versus like the leg hold trap? I'm pretty sure the leg hold traps are shallow water near like a caster mound, maybe some sticks or something to attract them to bring them in, right? I mean, I don't really know.
Yeah, and so we could do 3 hours and I'd get all jacked up on all the different sets you could make for a beaver. But so if someone says, hey, I'm interested in beaver trapping and I'd like to try to catch a beaver, my first question is, you know, are you looking for the experience of the whole trapping experience, or do you want a beaver? Because if you just want a beaver, wait for the spring. That's when they're territorial, when the water's open. It's easier to get around as a trapper, right? It's easier to get two sets. And they're super responsive to caster, just like you're talking about. So the easiest set to make for a beginner is a caster mount set. You know, you want to neck down a channel, and you're going to place your body grip in between the bank where you're going to put your caster, either a bait or a lure, and where they're coming from. And so the idea is, hey, they're trying to get to your caster, and you're forcing them through your body grip. So that's kind of the easiest set. It has a really high productivity rate. But for the experience, I really recommend trapping through the ice. There's few things as rewarding as pulling a big flat tail out of a small hole in the ice. It's a time of year where you can interact with these habitats that it's the only time of year you can interact with these habitats. You know, you've been out in a beaver marsh in July and August. It's horrendous. No one wants to be out there. You're up, you know, you're wallowing up to your waist and the mosquitoes and the bugs. Whereas in the wintertime, it's frozen. You're seeing things in different angles that you never see before, and kind of breaking down where the hut is and where the food bed is and where the runs might be. It's a little bit more technical, and you end up with this relationship with the individual you catch that we just love. And it's also from a food standpoint, you catch a beaver under ice and it's waiting for you in a cooler, essentially.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's the spring and you catch a beaver, let's say trapping around work, right? We all work full-time jobs, and it can be really hard to fit in a trap line around that. So maybe you're checking it after work and it's April 10th and that beaver's been deceased on the bank in the sun for, you know, 8-10 hours. So from a food standpoint, and it's a bit cleaner in that standpoint. You know, you're handling animals that are kind of tightened up from being chilled in an ice box under ice.
Yeah. So what are the sets then where like a lot of people put like, I don't know what size wire, 9 wire or whatever, with like a cinder block or something heavy, and they throw it out and then they put the traps, and the traps have like a one direction, like, I don't know, what do you call that device that goes on the wire?
So you'll hear me call it a submersion device.
Okay.
And you'll hear me use all these fancy BMP words. And so I'm really big on trapping communications, right? And so the biggest thing that we're dealing with as trappers is people just don't know, right? They have this image in their head of Disney, big bear tooth trap, and this poor little animal that's, you know, waiting for someone to come and whatever it may be, where it's not the case. And so we try really hard to use the correct terminology and the, you know, things that are easier to digest from someone who, whether they want to go out and trap tomorrow or not, they have, it's just easier for them to accept and acknowledge that this activity is still occurring. So that's called a submersion device. You're going to hear it most commonly called a drowning wire or a drowning device, you know, a drowning set. But again, beavers don't drown because they don't, you know, inhale water like you and I do. But yeah, so that's, you know, using a foothold. And so setting a foothold either depends if you want a front foot or a back foot catch. And this is where I really get into the technicality in the spring of reading, you know, okay, how's this beaver going to approach this set? Right? Am I looking for a front foot? Am I looking for a back foot? Am I trying to catch that smart beaver who's avoided a bunch of my body grips? Well, I'm going to want my trap to be a little bit more hidden, so I'm going to go for a back foot catch. I'm going to want to be 6 to 10 inches underwater and 12 to 16 inches back from where that animal's going to land. And you're thinking about the size of animal of the animal you're targeting. I know I'm targeting a mature beaver here, so I want to set this further back so I can avoid the kits. You know, the kits are going to swim right over this set, whereas that big beaver is going to stomp down in this area. And then the idea is they get caught either by the front foot, back foot, whatever you have it set for. And that cable has a one-way slide. Their natural reaction when they, you know, when they encounter something that's nervous them is to dive. So they're going to jump back out of the water, dive down, and it's going to hold them underwater until they expire from, you know, CO2 in their bloodstream.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Wow. So then how do you know you're targeting a big beaver versus a small beaver? Are you reading sign or are you actually like scouting? In my mind, I wish I could just hunt beavers. Like, I don't know. I think it'd be cool. It's cool to trap because, you know, your odds of success are way higher because you can cover multiple areas, right? And then you're covering more ground that way. But at the same time, like, I just want to maybe even just hunt beavers. I think it'd be cool, but.
Yeah, maybe even like with a bow, like like a self bow, that might be kind of cool. I think recovery, you know, you might need a golden retriever to help, or, you know, a retriever to help you with a help with recovery.
No, you need the bow fishing reel with the line.
Oh, yeah. you got this all figured out. It's you know, and that is the thing about trapping. You just touched on it yourself, is that you have more opportunity, and you can also kind of go as hard as you want. You can have one set out behind the house, out behind the office, whatever it may be, and tend to that set for a while. Or you can go really hard and have 35, 50 sets out and you know, really kind of start getting after those numbers. But to your question about how do you know if there's a big beaver? Well, the easiest thing is just like a big buck rubbing a big tree, right? Like a big buck can rub a small tree, but a spike horn's not rubbing that 10-inch maple up. It's kind of the same with beavers. A big beaver will eat a small tree, but a small beaver is not going to be targeting those 25-inch yellow birch that are on the side of the of the flowage. So when you show up to a flowage and you see these massive trees that are gnawed, okay, we're dealing with a big colony here. Also, just size of the hut, right? You know, the bigger the hut, the bigger the colony, and the bigger the colony, there's multiple generations, and once you get two or three generations in, grandma and grandpa are just, they're going to have some size to them.
Yeah.
Okay. Leads me to my next question then. What is the biggest beaver you've ever caught?
Yeah, we actually just caught that animal a couple weeks ago, 60.6 pounds. It was a big female. And that same day we caught her mate, which was a 52 pound male. So 50 pounds is that category where you pull them out of the ice or you pull them out of the water and you're like, holy crap. Can you believe rodents get this big? But 60 was a whole new level. I was pretty pumped on that.
That's awesome. So needless to say, those are all in the freezer and going to make some tasty backstraps.
Yeah, we actually, I had a thing for work where we had a bunch of people getting together. And so those two back legs have already been consumed. It fed 25 people. You know, a slider each, don't get me wrong. This isn't like, you know, going to be your whole lunch, but yeah, 25 people ate on the back legs from that beaver, and those back straps got eaten that night.
Nice.
Wow.
And of course, our sorry not to interrupt, but our dog also eats all the rest of the beaver that we're not capitalizing on. So that's a huge, huge, it's a financial saver on dog food. His coat is unbelievably, healthy looking, and he loves it. So when we're done with a beaver, between the skull, the castor glands, the tail that we're harvesting for leather, the meat, the pelt and everything, it's essentially a rib cage with with intestines in it. And we're utilizing, I've done this measurement out a couple times now, but it's about 65 to 70% of the live weight of that animal. So, when we talk about deer, bear, we're talking about dressed weight, but we're talking live weight. So it's a substantial amount of that animal that can be utilized.
Yep. I have to ask you real quickly, how in the name of God do you tell the sex of a beaver when they have a cloaca? Because every time I've just been like, I don't know, man.
Yeah. So
you got to open it up, Clay.
You got to open it up. Is the short version. So when you skin them, between the castor sacs, right? So if you're gonna skin your castor sacs out, just when you remove that first layer of flesh to see the castor, there's either right behind where the two castor sides meet, there's either a penis or there ain't. There's either a big tube or there's not.
And I thought there was a. Don't they have cloacas though?
We're inside the cloaca now.
Okay.
Right. So you've skinned your beaver. So you've gone around the cloaca.
Okay.
And it's just the meat of the animal, or it's the naked beaver.
Yeah.
And where the castor sits, which is just behind the cloaca, if you skin back the flesh, like you're going to harvest the castor.
Yeah.
That's where you see it.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. I guess I just never paid attention.
On big beavers, like anything over 40 pounds, a female has bred by that point in her life. And so if she's bred and she's nursed, then her nipples are going to be slightly descended. And so
I see.
The first thing I do when I pull a beaver out of the ice or out of the water is I feel right next to that front foot. And if there's a big nipple, it's a female. If there's a small nipple, I can't tell you one way or the other, but it's likely a male.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because I have actually skinned and saved a few castor sets throughout the years. And boy, do those, they're not popular in my household. Got to keep those out in the shed. I never knew that little technique.
So you mean you didn't make like ice cream with it or anything, Clay?
No castor ice cream. No. But I tell you, I did find my son shot a raccoon this year.
Oh, cool.
And we right out back here, sitting up on a tree. I forgot actually until right now. I set its
baculum.
It's baculum. Because I was skinning and I was like, what the? I was like, oh my God, this is its baculum.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so that's sitting out there on the tree out in my backyard right now.
Didn't they used to use the baculums for for cleaning their flintlocks or something? Like they had a significant purpose back in the pioneer and the settler days, that they were a useful tool. The baculums were used for something to do with the black powder muskets or something.
It makes sense. It's got a wicked curve to it.
Yeah,
I know it's been used for toothpicks and whiskey stirrers. And, the raccoon and
picking
the
banjos.
Otter raccoon and otter baculums have a wicked curve to them. Coyotes are kind of just a straight bone. But
Wow.
And dire wolves used to break them all the time. So,
ouch. So you're mostly trapping then. For food for your family, and I saw on your page that you alluded to a lot ways to communicate about trapping that make people not so defensive about it. Yeah. And one thing that I really enjoyed that you said was not demonizing the animals, because I feel a lot of hunters, they'll kind of puff themselves up and be like, I'm doing this good service because these things are these horrible, you know, monsters haunting all, you know. And I saw that video of yours and I was like, ah, thank God. Somebody who's like just talking about like the sustainability of it.
Yeah, you're never going to hear us talk about the bad beaver, the bad coyote, you know, the you'll never hear me use the word nuisance. You know, if we are helping a neighbor, a farmer, you know, deal with a beaver situation, it's a conflict, right? It's not nuisance. That beaver didn't wake up in the morning and go, do you know what I'm going to do to Farmer Billy today? No, that beaver just found ideal habitat, set up shop, and is doing what a beaver does best. And so, and same things with coyotes. And predator management can be difficult because predators eat critters that we like, that we like to eat. And so there's this, there's this kind of rough between the human and the predator that's been here forever. But generally speaking, you know, we trap because we're trapping abundant species. Trapping does not negatively impact these species, but having a community of people that have these skills can help us when there is conflict with individual wildlife species. And so that's kind of the way that we try to frame it, you know, because it was the last week of the season. There's a vegetable farmer just up the road here. The beavers had, impounded a section of kind of drainage, and his whole field was underwater. And he calls me and he is in a panic. You know, I have to plan in the coming weeks and I don't know what I'm going to do. And so we went and removed those individuals, and it's a win-win.
Yeah.
In three nights, we can remove that. That colony, we're getting food, we're getting fur, and the farmer's getting relief. And so instead of painting it as like, you know, this darn beaver went and did X, Y, and Z, it's, hey, look at how everybody can win from having a trapper in your community.
Yeah. Plus they're so numerous, you know, which I know that you've gone over to, and I faced the exact same thing throughout the years. You tell people you trap, they say, but they're almost extinct.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we get so much of that on our beaver stuff in particular. You know, well, how could you? This is illegal. Okay, well, first off, you know, it's not illegal. This is a highly regulated activity. But beavers are a rodent. They've got productivity rate. You know, they're having 4 to 6 young a year every year. And in a landscape that does not have a lot of trappers, that does not have a lot of natural mortality, you know, that becomes exponential real fast, and the optimal habitat becomes limited really fast. So now you have conflicts between beavers. And Clay, you've trapped beavers. You know what the back of a beaver looks like in spring when they're in a landscape that's saturated with beavers. It's bit to hell. You know, they're absolutely beat up, and it's a vicious life out there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Beavers in particular.
Yeah, very the renewable resource.
Yeah.
No, you said about muskrats too, though, Clay, right? Like the muskrats.
Oh, well, muskrats are even, I mean, those are, in my opinion, the ultimate renewable resource. I mean, what can they experience? Like a 90% mortality per year?
It's something like that. There's some famous study from the late 30s where they essentially found that the more muskrat that are trapped from wetlands, like the healthier and larger the next year's crop is.
Yeah. Muskrats.
But, you know, fun. Sorry. We're talking about rodents, but you know, other species like bobcats or fisher that may not have as high of a productivity rate, like it's still, or that may not be as abundant on the landscape, are still abundant in their own ways, and it's still okay to trap those species. You know, otter is another really good example. You know, they're not pumping out 6 young per year, but they're a large ranging species. They need specific habitats. And if we're not part of that management, it's disease and predation.
Mm-hmm.
So are you guys primarily trapping beavers then, or do you actually pursue other species then?
Beavers are bread and butter for sure. We do a bit of fisher trapping in the fall. I like to run a raccoon line for 2 weeks every October. It's kind of like, you know, I've got to scratch that trapping itch before deer season, because during deer season, everything else in life gets put on hold. So scratch the trapping itch, deer hunt, And then I've got a ritual the day I hang up my rifle, whether it means I, you know, harvested in the states that I, you know, whether I'm out of tags or I'm out of season, the next day I set a beaver trap. And the last couple of years we've had sets in the water essentially every day until the end of our season, which is April 10th. But while we're beaver trapping, we're also targeting otter when we get good sets, you know, good spots for them, and muskrat when we're in flowages that show good muskrat sign.
Yeah. Ever ate a muskrat?
I haven't yet. It's on the to-do list.
I've eaten a number of muskrats. They're interesting.
Yeah. In what way?
Hey, I personally am kind of like, I've skinned enough muskrats that, you know, like with a beaver, you skin it and you're like, oh, okay. Like, it's got like a pretty pleasant smell. I mean, there's a reason why castor is added to colognes, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, muskrat, there's something that just kind of disturbs me about the smell. You know, you're skinning them and they're like super easy. Like, they only take like, what, just a few minutes to pull that.
Sure.
Yeah. But like, you're sitting there and you're just like, ugh, there's something off-putting about this yeah. odor. And then, unless you like really season them, that smell kind of comes through, in my opinion. And maybe that's just me being a little picky.
Yeah. That's like the first time I ate bobcat. Uh-huh. I had just put up a bobcat, like finished fleshing, and then came inside and like put the bobcat on the grill. And there was something about the, you know, the smell of the fat from fleshing it that I just couldn't get out of my nose when I sat down to eat it.
Oh my God.
I've now had it since then multiple times and, you know, had really good experiences with it.
Yeah.
You know, the key is just to not, you know, roll in bobcat fat before you eat
bobcat. That's how I feel about a coyote. And I know that's pretty controversial whether or not people want to eat a coyote, but like, just when you're skinning it, like trying to think of like the pneumonia, urine, urea type smell is just overwhelming.
Yeah. And it's a dog.
Yeah. You know?
And so this brings up a really good point. Like when people say, oh, why do you trap? I trap for food and for fur, and in that order, honestly, but it's okay to harvest an animal just for fur.
Mm-hmm.
And I shouldn't even say just, it's okay to harvest an animal for fur. You know, when that carcass goes back out into the environment, Mother Nature's not wasting that.
Oh,
you know,
no.
It's not like you're throwing it in a plastic, you know, you're not tying it up in a plastic bag and throwing it in the landfill. I hope you're not, at least. giving it back to Mother Nature, the microbes need that, you know, the shrews are eating on, or the voles are eating on it. And there's a whole system that's occurring out there that is set up to utilize decaying flesh. So you know, beavers are a really good kind of poster child for trapping because we get so much out of them, but it's okay to harvest fisher for, you know, just the pelt. It's okay to harvest a coyote for the pelt. I always just like to plug that it's a renewable resource. That individual has replaced itself on the landscape already. And these species are highly abundant.
Yeah. I have a question for you in regards to the coyote or coyote.
There you go.
Yeah. I don't know which way to say it. I grew up saying coyote. I actually kind of feel as if the way somebody says it, like, betrays like how they feel about it.
Ah, okay.
like you kind of hear somebody say coyote and you go, ah, they don't like them. And then, and then you hear somebody say coyote and you go, you assume the opposite. Ah, they like coyote. You know, they like them.
Yeah.
But either way, maybe that's inaccurate. My question though, you're a wildlife biologist, right?
Yep.
Is the coyote, would you consider it to be an invasive species, or would you consider it to be a species that has expanded its range due to an absence of wolf?
I'm going with the latter, and I don't think that there's a right and a wrong answer to that. I think that you can spin that however you want. Personally, I feel that it's a predator species that's filling a niche that has been left open by not just the wolf, but the mountain lion, all of these large predators that, you know, we had on our landscape at one point in time. Here in northern New England, you know, that rule of body size with, you know, as you go north has applied to our coyotes. So we have coyotes that are pushing 55, 65 pounds. These are really large dogs on the landscape. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't consider them invasive. I've got a little bit of love for the coyote in the sense that, man, we've tried to get rid of that thing. Like since we showed up here on boats, we've been trying to get rid of the coyote. And there's more of them than we know what to do with. So I think if you just look at it from a species perspective, it's kind of it's a success story in their eyes, in the coyote's eyes. But and again, a phenomenal resource when you start looking at their fur for whether it's mittens or ruffs or hats or all these different things. They're warm. They have a really good icing, they have a low icing standard. Yeah, that's a good looking coyote, Luke, which means that when we breathe out in cold temperatures, you know, we like on our eyelashes and our hair gets kind of crystallized. Well, coyotes don't. And so that's, you know, there is a reason that dog, coyotes and wolves have been used for ruffs for so long.
Speaking of that, Patagonia decided to do away with their use of coyote fur to line their the hoods on their jackets.
Yeah, are they gonna dig up some dinosaurs and make petroleum based fake fur? And nothing gets me more revved up than seeing fake fur ruffs, because we have so many coyotes and we need stuff to do with them, and they have a utility as a ruff, but no. Because someone can't internalize death, they would rather, you know, have some factory in China use a petroleum-based product to make this ugly-looking fur knockoff, ship it all the way to the U.S. just so they can pat themselves on the back and say that they're green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, that was my rant about
Yvon Chouinard is a very strange dude anyway. Like, I mean, he's...
yeah.
That's a whole different story, though.
I just basically can't understand it from many perspectives, but the sustainability issue is another one. You know, at some point, right, like, don't they say the average age of a trapper moves up 1 year every year?
You're probably right.
And I personally know that I can often go a whole season and never ever see any sign of another trapper having been around where I'm trapping.
Yeah.
And so, like, what happens in the future when this is gone, you know?
Well, I'm gonna take the optimist approach to answering that, which is I think that we just need to market it a little differently to the millennials of the world. What we've seen through doing the social media stuff is that we all know there's an interest in becoming more self-reliant in, say, 35 and younger, 40 and younger right now. And trapping is a low, specifically beavers, right? It's a low input for high output activity. You can go out and in three or four trap nights in open water, you can catch a beaver. You're getting meals aplenty. You're getting fur that can be turned into things. You're getting leather, all the things we've talked about so far. So we've seen a growing interest in that 25 to 30 year old group. It's just breaking down that barrier of entry. It takes a lot to get into trapping, and not so much trapping. You could buy a single body grip and a bottle of lure and go out and catch yourself a beaver tomorrow for under $50. But now what?
Yeah.
You know, so the barrier to entry really is in fur handling and animal preparation. But yeah, that growing interest. So here around us, I was the only trapper for a while until we started making this social media content. And now there's four other young people our age, you know, 30 years old, that have started beaver trapping. And so now within, you know, my quote unquote territory, I guess it's a blessing and a curse. all of a sudden I'm running into other trappers that we've helped mentor.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that we do with our fur shed for people around here. It's like, it takes so much capital and time to build up a place to properly prepare fur. And so we have an open door policy, you know, come in, start up the wood stove, you know, here's the fleshing beam, all the skinning stuff, you know, use it as you would yourself. close the door on the way out. And we've seen that be really successful for helping, like I said, now three groups of people get into trapping who, you know, they're filing their fur reports next year to make sure they can get their license, or this year to make sure they can get their license next year.
Wow.
So that's my pitch is, take someone out, you know, open door policy. The trapping community has always been very secluded, you know, by design, but also back in the 60s when fur was, you know, you could buy a new pickup on a year's worth of fur, there was right. legit competition. And so people didn't want to share these secrets per se. And so my pitch to anybody who traps is take someone else with you, you know, share equipment, just help get that hurdle over that first hurdle.
Do you think that fur prices are directly related to like the low numbers of trappers right now?
I think that fur prices, I think that fluctuations in fur prices are realized in fluctuations of intensity, not necessarily number of individual trappers. So John is going to trap every single year, but if beavers go through the roof, he might really target some beavers. Whereas if they're low, he might catch two or three. So we've seen pretty consistent trapper numbers in New England, but that intensity, like was it 2012 when coyotes went through the roof? You know, all of a sudden the next year, the coyote harvest just about doubled because people were trying, but the number of trappers didn't change.
Okay.
Wow. This is a question that probably pertains more to your social media stuff, but in getting that message out, don't you think that the social media companies kind of make it hard on that front? Like YouTube will straight up demonetize you for showing the content that you show. Instagram, I mean, most hunters, maybe you can't agree with this, but most hunters agree you put the hashtag hunter in anything, and your thing's going to get less views. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree, but I guess I'm in the middle. So certain platforms and like TikTok, we learned how to make content on TikTok, and my wife talked me into it. You know, we were trying to build New England Naturals to sell our products. Like that was the whole impetus behind making social media thing was just to sell, you know, some beaver koozies. And TikTok, we blew up in a short period of time unexpectedly. So we learned the algorithm, how to make content, all that stuff. And then we hit a wall and something happened literally overnight. We had a bunch of videos get taken down. I mean, that kind of stuff, you're always battling it. But then on Instagram, that growth has kind of continued and the views don't, it's hard to say. And it also depends on the animal. So like, handling beavers, not so much. You show a coyote pelt, and that gets taken down, it gets reported, all that type stuff. So yeah, social media is I don't know what the future of it's going to be, but we're kind of just going to ride it until they kick us off. I'm sure Meta's listening, but I assume it's going to happen at some point. You know, we'll get booted and that'll be that for New England Naturals on social media. But we're going to keep fighting a good fight up until then.
Yeah, that's like I saw a guy posted a video of two toms fighting over a hen decoy. And he was turkey hunting. Nothing else, just the two toms fighting. And YouTube took his video down, locked his account, and said, you know, malicious intent of having animals or putting animals together in order to make them fight. And he's like, I didn't make them do anything. I just posted a video of them two fighting. I mean, they unlocked his account, but they still wouldn't let him put the video up. And it's like, holy cow. I mean, that's something, it's just nature. It's, I mean, but you could have another channel that's nature is metal and have, you know, a jaguar take something in its mouth and thrash it and it's okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we get hit with animal abuse most often. Yeah, our videos that get taken down get flagged for animal abuse. TikTok offered to help us find counseling.
Oh my god.
No way.
Yeah, it was some like, you know, click here for community links to places you can get help. And yeah, so no, it's tough. And that's again why we try to push the like I try to show the beaver pelt in all the forms of preparation as preparing clothing, right? Like this is the first step. The first step in preparing clothing is catching a beaver, you know, and then going from there. And who knows, you know, we'll have spouts of growth and then it'll just shut off. And I assume it's because we're getting reported enough, you know, like I mentioned before we started here, there's quite a few anti-trapping groups that have our number that are constantly reporting us. You know, they work they're very targeted. They're very, they got a lot of intent behind what they're doing. And they'll have these campaigns where they'll send out a message and 50 people will report your video in a short period of time and it gets booted. We try really hard to block all of the different, I mean, like I have gone through and typed in every form of HSUS that you can find in, you know, on Instagram and block them. Some of the more local, I refer to them as animal extremists or, you know, wildlife terrorist groups. I mean, they're trying to prevent us from managing wildlife species. So yeah, we try to just block them. You know, they don't want to see our content. We don't want them to see our content.
There you go. There's nothing wrong with blocking somebody for sure.
No.
Yeah.
No. I highly recommend it to all the different hunting groups. Like if someone comments on one of our, you know, posts with @PETA, it's like, perfect. Thanks. You just gave me another person to block. You just showed me. Or my favorite is when they show me anti-groups. You know, someone will tag, you know, Wildlife for All. And you click on it. It's like, oh man, how did I miss this one? Thank you very much, block. And I'm going to block the person who sent it.
That's what I find funny though, is when people are like, oh, you take the time to actually respond to people's comments and try to educate them. So obviously some you cannot,
but
somebody may make a comment and say, oh, that's so mean or that's cruel. Or how could you do? I've seen where you post and like, we'll post their question and then answer it. And try to, for the best of your ability. I mean, but man, I don't even know if I'd have time to do that. I'd just say, you know what, just let them go. But
yeah, and so there's a fine line there, and you know, you'll hear Joe Rogan say, "Don't watch the comments." Well, we kind of have to filter ours to a certain degree, or else that anti-community is going to build in the comments, and our stuff's going to get taken down. You know, we're trying to form a community online of where, you know, new hunters, new trappers can come to get information and find that community. And so we do put a little bit of effort into it. If you see something that looks like it's got like a targeted message, like, you know, the animals that we trap are abundant, you know, this activity is managed by wildlife agencies using modern science, that's me. If you see something that's got like pretty good satire and is like a good dig at someone, it's Riley. Yeah, she's got all the humor that's associated with our account, because some people are just too easy.
Yeah. I just don't know where are they going? You know, what do they want to achieve? They it seems like largely a waste of time. You know, they're going to get to their goal someday and we're all going to be these like hairless soy eating, you know, monkeys, and there's going to be like beaver flooding everywhere and coyotes all over the landscape and you know, no deer left. And
but you'll be living in a smart city then, Clay. You won't have to worry about that. You won't see that.
But what is their ultimate goal? Then it's going to be like, crap, you know, their grandchildren are going to be like, we got to figure out how to trap these things.
How to deal with these beavers. Does anyone know how to take care of it? No, the last guy died 100 years ago. Yeah, no, I mean, their end goal is just to never see. And this is what gets me. Their end goal is to never see a human take the life of a wild animal.
Yeah.
But they're okay with, and I would like to force them to watch a coyote eat a deer while it's still alive.
Yeah.
I would like to force them to to stay with a fox in the last 16 hours of mange before it takes its life.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it just make them sit down and say, okay, watch this fox. Because I could have caught that fox last fall before it had mange, and then I could have utilized it as a product that's going to outlive the biological lifespan of that individual, and didn't have to come from overseas, didn't take petroleum to make it. You know, all these different things. They don't want to hear it. You know, to them, they just can't fall asleep at night if someone is harvesting animals, and you know that's the hill they're going to die on.
Yeah. Don't you think that a lot of it relates back to a fear of death? Like, I was driving my kids to school this morning, and we were talking about the concept of death and dying. We just had a family member, an older family member, in her 80s die. And I kind of commented and said, you know, that seems like an age appropriate for that to happen. And while it is sad, like, that is generally considered to be like a human lifespan.
Yeah.
And we were talking about it, and my kids, you know, they've been around animals. Like, we kill chickens, we kill, you know, deer, we shoot squirrels, we hunt beaver, or I mean, we trap beaver.
Yeah.
So like, death to them is like this concept that's kind of like not a hard thing for them to grasp. And, but there seems to be like a fear of death that drives all of this.
A fear of death and a detachment from the natural world.
Correct.
You know, yeah. You know, just go out and watch a squirrel collect nuts all day just to be consumed by a fisher.
Yeah.
And that fisher, you know, goes ambling down and falls out of a tree and cracks its neck. And you know, like, it's just mortality and that fear of, I just don't think that they've ever actually seen what death looks like in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know that I can give that beaver a mortality that is much more quicker, much more mm-hmm. ethical by the human standard, mind you. Like, we're applying human principles because Mother Nature doesn't have ethics. She just mm-hmm. has rules. You either eat and you live, or you don't and you die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. That's, you know, natural death for a beaver is starvation and disease and predation. Yeah, probably and I won't go too far down this road because it's a whole other realm, but when I got my master's, it was on moose in Vermont and factors of mortality. And it, you know, it comes down to winter ticks. And so you have these calf moose that are literally being sucked dry of blood in the spring months when they're nutritionally depleted. It's a numbers game. I mean, it's literally milliliters. There are more milliliters of blood being removed from the body than the calf can produce in a day.
Wow.
And yet we still have these big picket signs of people that say, stop hunting the moose. Whereas if that calf moose was harvested 3 months prior, it would be as healthy as it is. It's got all its fat too. It's got a beautiful pelt, and it's got, you know, I don't know what, 500 meals for a family. And so it's just this detachment from, it's trying to remove us from the system, and we can't. We're too integrated into the wild world around us. There is that sense of like natural, just Mother Nature doing her thing, doesn't exist in the vast majority of the United States.
Wow. Yeah. Luke, you got to get out and trap some beavers, man.
I do. So I got to ask you about these koozies real quick. Is that like the only products you guys are producing, or are you producing on your own other things as well? What kind of products?
I will say, yeah, the koozie is the only thing that we can keep on the website long enough. So we produce, you know, mittens, muffs. So, you know, for hunting late season, you know, clip around the back, headbands, raccoon, you know, the classic Daniel Boone hat. So we make a bunch of different products, but the second that we finish one, it's sold. And the other issue is when you're trapping all winter long, and then you're putting up fur all night of all winter, making the products is where we fall short. So summer is our catch up time. We're going to try really hard this next year to kind of get ahead on some products before we release stuff. Because we're running into, you know, you put one muff up and it's like 12 minutes later, it's gone. It's like,
holy cow.
You know, sorry, guys. You know, and then we get message after message after message for when are these going to be back in stock. So the koozie is just the only product that we can keep up with and keep in stock.
Nice. Okay.
But yeah, we make a lot of other stuff. We don't just trap beavers for koozies. I'll say that.
But it would be okay if you did.
Yeah. I saw you had, or your wife had, in one of the pictures, she had some mittens.
Yeah.
So each of you guys, I'm assuming, have beaver mittens.
Yeah, we each have several different types of mittens for different, you know, temperatures and stuff. So her mittens, her work mittens are otter, And those are just beautiful, but they're also really rugged. And that's the other pitch for using fur, is it's really, really durable. My daily drivers are beaver mittens, but for really cold temps, I have bear mittens from a black bear that I harvested in New Hampshire. And she has raccoon mittens for when we're going to be in deep snow, because that snow, the raccoon helps keep the snow off of the actual hand. And then she's got a couple different headbands. And, you know, we try to incorporate fur into our daily life, but also like when we're out and about, just, you know, destigmatize fur.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a beaver fur comforter?
That is, we made my mother a plucked and sheared dyed black just throw blanket. So 4XL beaver pelts. And that thing, I mean, you can't put it over you for more than a couple minutes. It sweats you out. It's impressive. Nice. And it's also gorgeous.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be great if you actually didn't have heat or something that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Which you'd want. It's been great talking to you. Jake, before we go, just kind of curious, you know, where can everybody find you, find the socials that we've talked about, potentially purchase products when they're in stock, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, so you can find us on all the major social media platforms at New England Naturals. And then we'll have a link in all those different platforms that go to our website where you can find products and stickers. We're all about the stickers.
Nice. Well,
I'm going to definitely have to check out your stickers, because I'll help support for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. It's great talking to you, and we appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you could check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.